Programming support comes from Center for Craft, located at 67 Broadway Street in downtown Asheville. Center for Craft provides a variety of resources for creative entrepreneurs, offering workspace options from private offices to flex desks for individuals or teams. More info can be found at their website, centerforcraft.org, or by calling 828-785-1357.
You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFMLP 103.3 Asheville, and this is the AFM NewsHour. I'm News Team Correspondent KP Whaley. The AFM NewsHour theme music is composed by local artist Alusha Tistas. Views and opinions expressed on the AFM NewsHour do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, its board of directors, or program sponsors. For questions, feedback, story suggestions, and more, please email us at news@ashevillefm.org. And you can also find our stories on Facebook at Asheville FM. On today's edition of the AFM NewsHour, we're joined by a policy advocate with Toxic Free NC and their work towards safe alternatives to harmful pesticides and chemicals. We'll speak with someone from Green Built Alliance about their expansion of their Energy Savers Network in Asheville and Buncombe County. A community radio project brings light to families of incarcerated folks and the prison industrial complex. Dr. Dick Needleman will bring us our daily dose of healthy Asheville and more. But first, let's take a look at this week's headlines with News Team correspondent Cannon Wiest.
Hello, this is Cannon, and here are your headlines this week. At its April 2nd meeting, the Board of Commissioners voted to move forward developing affordable housing on county-owned properties at 50 and 52 Cox Avenue in downtown Asheville. With 200 proposed units, the estimated construction cost comes in at $59.1 million. Units are designated at 80% or less of area median income, and the current area median household income is just north of $68,000. The proposal comes after more than 120 community members provided input on two possible development options through in-person and virtual opportunities. The other option included a reduced footprint that only utilizes the property at 50 Cox Avenue for 130 units. Commissioner Amanda Edwards said at the meeting that this puts the county on a forward path to achieving its goal of maximizing county land to build 1,800 affordable housing units. For those frequent flyers out of Asheville, or for those who frequently hate lines at airports, we'll have an opportunity to help mitigate that by signing up for TSA PreCheck when the mobile enrollment truck visits Asheville Regional from April 15th to 18th. Appointments are available on those 4 days and will provide an easy opportunity for anyone who has ever been envious of those breezing through security. Appointments can be made at www.flyavl.com/PreCheck. Asheville continues to be the place to be, according to one online moving cost aggregator. According to data collected by Move Buddha, Asheville sees an incoming to outgoing ratio of 3.29 to 1, meaning that for every 329 moves to the city, only 100 are leaving. Asheville sits at number 2 on that list, only behind the noted and notorious Florida retirement community, the Villages. Granted, these are just estimates, but the data shows a slight uptick from last year, and city population numbers seem to correlate. The Northeast and Florida are two areas that send us the most people, with Texas and California also seeing an uptick in new resident deliveries. Almost 3 in 10 child care centers throughout North Carolina say they'd be forced to close if state lawmakers don't step in with financial support when pandemic-era grants expire this summer. That many closures, about 29%, would mean a loss of care for some 91,000 children in the state. This would have ripple effects on the broader economy, experts say. Pandemic-era stabilization grants address two areas, operational costs and pay. The grants covering operational costs ended last April. The ones covering pay are set to expire on June 30th. These grants increased average teacher salaries by $2 to $3 an hour, says Janet Singerman, president and CEO of Child Care Resources Incorporated. Still, child care teacher salaries remain around $14 to $15 an hour in North Carolina. The North Carolina General Assembly is about to enter into a short session on April 24th. Child care professionals are asking for a one-time allocation of $300 million to extend stabilization grants beyond June. More than 150 students, staff, and alumni have reportedly been diagnosed with cancers and other diseases linked to a university building teeming with toxins. The dozens of cancer cases and their links to the university building were exposed by a months-long investigation by station WRAL. Cases of lymphoma and thyroid and breast cancers have been reported among patients who spent time at Poe Hall, a class building at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. The building closed in November 2023 amid reports of exposure to concerning levels of polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, toxic chemicals linked to cancer. An investigation the month before found that PCB levels in five rooms were more than 38 times the EPA's building limit. The university now faces lawsuits from some of the 152 patients who reported falling sick with diseases linked to the toxins. Poe Hall, which held education and psychology classes for thousands of students, was constructed in 1971 when PCBs were commonly used in industrial products like oils, insulators, and electric appliances such as TV sets, lighting, and refrigerators. PCBs, including those used to build Poe Hall, were largely mass-produced by agricultural giant Monsanto until they were banned in 1979 amid concerns that they harmed humans and the environment. According to the EPA, conclusive evidence has found that PCBs can cause cancer in animals, as well as harm their immune, reproductive, nervous, and endocrine systems. The building officially closed in November, and the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services recommended the university request a health hazard evaluation. A health hazard evaluation is a federal investigation into a workplace to look for hazards such as carcinogens. However, the investigation was called off in January by NC State's general counsel, according to the CDC. North Carolina State University Chancellor Randy Woodson denied the CDC's report with a lawyer writing, "At no time has NC State requested that the National Institute for Occupational Safety Health close any health hazard evaluation." A powerful 7.4 magnitude earthquake rocked Taiwan on Wednesday, the strongest tremor to hit the island in at least 25 years, killing at least four people, injuring dozens, and sparking nearby Japan to issue a brief evacuation advisory for coastal areas. The quake hit shortly before 8 a.m. local time, according to Taiwan's Central Weather Administration. The quake's epicenter was located about 96 miles southeast of Taipei. Rescue operations are ongoing, and aftershocks have caused residents to flee their homes and remain outside, Taiwan's official central news agency reported. The United States Geological Survey recorded numerous aftershocks in the same region, including one with a magnitude of 6.5. Taiwan's Central Weather Administration said it recorded more than 25 aftershocks. There was no tsunami threat to Hawaii or the U.S. Pacific Territory of Guam, according to the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center, and no tsunami threat is expected for the west coast of North America, the U.S. National Tsunami Warning Center said. Israel's top military commander formally acknowledged on Wednesday that its military had made a grave mistake and apologized for the attack on an aid convoy that killed seven workers from the charity group World Central Kitchen, a rare admission of fault by Israel in the six-month-old war in the Gaza Strip. Israel's mea culpa marked a change in tone from Israel's military, which throughout the war has largely rejected criticism of its actions by arguing that it was doing what was necessary to defeat Hamas. It came as many of Israel's closest allies voiced indignation and demanded explanations for the attack. President Biden said he was outraged and heartbroken by the deaths of the humanitarian workers. "Incidents like yesterday's simply should not happen," he said in a statement. The World Central Kitchen workers, a Palestinian, an Australian, a Pole, three Britons, and a dual U.S.-Canadian citizen, were traveling in clearly marked cars after leaving a warehouse in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza when their convoy came under fire late Monday, the organization said in a statement. The Israeli military had been informed of the workers' movements, the charity said. The killings drew condemnation from countries around the world, including those of the people killed, and prompted aid agencies to reassess their operations in Gaza. World Central Kitchen, which was founded by the renowned chef Jose Andres, said on Tuesday that it was suspending its operations in Gaza. Israeli military chief of staff, Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi, said that an independent body would investigate the killings and that the military would learn from the conclusions and share the findings with the World Central Kitchen. President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping held a phone call on Tuesday, the first engagement between the leaders since their November summit in San Francisco, aimed at stabilizing turbulent U.S.-China relations. The two leaders last spoke on the phone in July 2022, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and Secretary of State Antony Blinken have held separate meetings with Wang Yi, the top Chinese diplomat in recent months, to pave the way for a presidential-level call. The White House said after the call that Biden had stressed the importance of peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait and the rule of law and freedom of navigation in the South China Sea. He also raised concern about Chinese support for Russia's defense industrial base and its impact on European and transatlantic security. A senior U.S. official said Biden was not expecting it to lead to any big announcements and that it was partly to check on the progress that had been made on agreements reached in San Francisco in November. She said the two leaders were also following through on a commitment to maintain regular open lines of communication to responsibly manage competition and prevent unintended conflict between the two powers. Later this week, U.S. and Chinese military officials will meet in Honolulu, resurrecting a once regular channel of communication that China halted after then U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi angered Beijing by visiting Taiwan in 2022. The U.S. official said the White House expected that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin would hold its first interaction with Dong Jun, the new Chinese defense minister, in the coming months. While the U.S. is keen to keep relations from becoming more turbulent, particularly in an election year, China has also been seeking to paint a picture of improving relations with Washington. This is Cannon, and those are your headlines this week.
Programming support is brought to you by Galactic Pizza, located at 339 Sardis Road in Asheville. Galactic Pizza serves pizza, salads, sandwiches, and more. They're open from noon to 8:30 p.m. every day for takeout and delivery with outdoor patio dining. More info is at galacticavl.com or call 828-633-0198. Asheville FM is thrilled to be named the best non-commercial radio station in Western North Carolina by the readers of Mountain Express. Looking forward, we will continue to offer the best programming, including music, talk, sports, and community events, and local news. So thank you for continuing to listen and supporting community radio in Asheville and beyond.
You're listening to the Asheville FM News Hour. Well, earlier this week, we spoke to Kendall Wimberly. She's a policy advocate with Toxic Free NC about Monsanto's latest attempt to avoid future lawsuits.
This is Pat Battle with the Asheville FM News Team. Today, we are talking with Kendall Wimberly of Toxic Free NC, and she's going to be talking to us about Monsanto, now Bayer, and their attempt to preempt the legality of lawsuits for liability for the impact of Roundup on people's health. Shortly after Bayer's acquisition of Monsanto, it lost a lawsuit in the Bay Area brought against it by a groundskeeper who had been using Roundup regularly on his job for his having contracted terminal non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The jury was convinced that Roundup was implicated in causing his lymphoma, and they gave him a $290 million settlement. Bayer experienced a blizzard of lawsuits by Roundup users claiming harm done to them by Roundup. Over the last several years, between settlements and jury verdicts against Bayer, it has paid out $14 billion to plaintiffs claiming that Roundup caused their non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or Parkinson's disease. Bayer has sought appellate relief to no avail. This year, in a move that may surprise many of our listeners, Bayer is seeking legislative relief on a state level. Kendall, can you tell us about this initiative on Bayer's part and where they are seeking such relief and what is the justification they give for why they shouldn't be liable?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Patrick. So big picture here, when Bayer merged with Monsanto, it was really bad news for people concerned about corporate responsibility and bad actors in our industrial food system. Through these lawsuits, a lot of what Monsanto knew and covered up about glyphosate and Roundup has been exposed. These uncovered documents are referred to as the Monsanto Papers. What has been made really clear is that the company knew about potential harms for many years and made deliberate attempts to cast doubt and take down scientific evidence. And now they have lost these cases in the courts. They're in a corner, and so their new tactic is to avoid further financial liability. So what we're seeing at the state level is Bayer is seeking these immunity bills to protect pesticide manufacturers from future lawsuits. Some people are calling it failure to warn legislation, since the legal cases have been around how these pesticide manufacturers failed to properly warn people about the harms of these chemicals. So Bayer's justification for this move is that they are already doing what the EPA requires in terms of pesticide labeling, and they don't have to do anymore. The bill text in these states are trying to narrow the focus of who can be held accountable. And this is a big concern that it could effectively take away people's ability to utilize the judicial system for any health harm as a result of pesticides, especially those beyond what EPA wants to recognize.
Yeah, indeed, this is about more than Roundup, but Roundup is the salient case of the moment. In 2015, the International Agency for Research on Cancer classified glyphosate as probably carcinogenic to humans. And way back in 1997, on an ag listserv I was following, I was seeing numerous references to the relationship between Roundup exposure and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Many, many juries have affirmed Roundup's role in causing these maladies, and yet the EPA insists that Roundup is safe. What is the disconnect about? How would consumers fare if they had to accept that the EPA can declare a pesticide safe, and once it does, that declaration absolves the pesticide producer of all liability?
Yeah, so the situation here with the IARC and the EPA has to do with the industry's influence in these decisions. The industries are following an industry playbook and using their power and billions of dollars in lobbying to take down specific scientists and to spread doubt on our scientific institutions. So despite our concerns about glyphosate, and we have many, what we really need is pesticide reform. We don't want these harmful chemicals singled out and replaced by other chemicals that could be even more harmful. Dicamba, atrazine, glyphosate, none of these products should be used as much as they are. The main point I want to make here is the need for the precautionary principle. There is a difference between having an assurance of safety about a product and having adequate risk mitigation. What folks need to understand about our current chemical regulation system is that right now it's asking, has this been proven dangerous? And our push at Toxic Free NC, we're really trying to get to that precautionary approach where the question is instead, has it been proven safe? So that's what we would like EPA to be moving towards.
At first, I was surprised to think that any legislator would believe they were serving their constituents by preempting their right to sue for recompense for harm caused by pesticides. But then I remembered that that's exactly what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission does with regards to nuclear power plants. Perhaps preemption is not as novel as one would have thought. Are there similar initiatives with regards to other pesticides? And how similar is the amendment that has been tacked onto the Farm Bill, which would force all local governments to confirm the federal pesticide regulations?
Yeah, so preemption has been coming up in a lot of different spaces, and we're seeing it play out here as a push and pull between state and federal government control. It's really important to have our checks and balances system, and within the environmental space, we need to protect what we have at the state and federal levels. Now is definitely not the time to be weakening our environmental standards. So what you're talking about in the Farm Bill is the Agricultural Labeling Uniformity Act. This is the pesticide preemption issue at the federal level. The aim of this bill is to take away state and local areas' ability to ban pesticides. We talk about preemption as a ban on bans. This bill would ban communities' ability to come together to restrict pesticides. And there are so many communities across the nation and here in North Carolina that have worked really hard to come together and get these types of pesticide bans to protect the health and biodiversity of their communities. Carrboro, North Carolina is definitely an example there. So we're wondering, like, why would we want to close the door on communities being able to come together to protect their children and workers and playgrounds on the front lines of these spray zones? Preemption is definitely something we're seeing play out right now, and we've been trying to engage the public and legislators on this important issue.
So is this legislation looking like it'll become law in any of these states? And what states is it currently before the legislatures? And what about North Carolina?
Yeah, so at the state level, we've seen these pesticide immunity bills in Missouri, Iowa, Idaho, and Florida. And these bills are written to cover any pesticide manufacturer, so not just Bayer, and we're concerned about that. To my knowledge, the attempts in Idaho have made it the farthest, but none of these bills have made it past the finish line. It's difficult to speculate on how all of this will play out, but the political reality we've seen these days is that anything is possible in taking our rights away. So we know folks on both sides of this are watching really closely, and in our current political climate, we are concerned about this in North Carolina, too.
How likely is it that North Carolina will see similar legislation introduced? And if preemption comes to North Carolina, what is Toxic and Free NC's game plan? Lobbying, grassroots organizing, both?
Yeah, so in North Carolina, the reality right now is we're already kind of limited in our ability to regulate pesticides. It's difficult at the state level, but it's important to be tracking these things. In North Carolina, our legislative session starts in late April. And to be truthful, this kind of pesticide immunity bill could arrive in our state legislature and could move quickly. So we need people aware of this issue and ready to act. So you asked about our game plan, and it's definitely both. We need farmers to speak up. We need parents. We need workers. This is a call to action for all who care about environmental health, biodiversity, the future of our planet, community power. And this is why we keep our eye on federal pesticide legislation and things happening in other states. Our state has a long history of conventional agriculture, and we need our state laws to be built around protecting and supporting people and our planet instead of industry's profit bottom line.
So what about how folks should be taking action here? Should we be taking action before it goes before the legislature? And if folks want to preempt preemption, how do they connect with Toxic Free NC to support Toxic Free NC and benefit from its leadership in the seemingly unending task of protecting our communities and our environment from toxic contamination?
Yeah, so we want people to be joining us in advocacy around this. You can be speaking up in your community, talking to people about what pesticide preemption means and what's at stake here. And to join us in this, you can follow our newsletter. We are working on an action alert petition specifically on this topic of preemption. You can find us at toxicfreenc.org. That's our website. And then you can also find us on Instagram at toxicfreenc. And we are a 501c3 nonprofit. We accept donations that help us do this really important work. Our power comes from the community, not just through donations, but through community voices. As an organization, we advocate for polluter accountability, for polluters to pay, for environmental justice. We really want to be moving toward the precautionary principle and toward pesticide reform. We want to help hold these pesticide manufacturers accountable to those who have been most impacted, and taking people's ability to sue is not the right move. We also want to remind you that you have agency in this too. You can choose not to support Bayer, and you can join us in fighting these attempts at harmful legislation. It is all of our responsibility to be supporting the health of our communities and environments.
That is an absolute. Thank you very much, Kendall, for coming out today and helping us to understand that we do have a say in this, and that we don't have to just sit back and see our ability to ask for recompense if we are affected by pesticides taken away from us.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much, Patrick.
Programming support is brought to you by our contributing listeners and by J.D. Ellison and Company, located at 42 South Market Street in Asheville. J.D. Ellison & Company is a full-service marketing agency focused on events, creative production, public relations, and strategy. More information is available at jdellison.com.
The Green Built Alliance is expanding their Energy Savers Network in Asheville and Buncombe County, and we got a chance to talk to them about their expansion earlier this week.
This is Pat Battle with the Asheville FM News Team. Today we're with Jamie Wine, and he's going to tell us about the Energy Savers Network. Jamie, tell us about it, please.
Okay. The Energy Savers Network is about lowering energy bills for income limited families. We're mostly in Buncombe County, and it's a couple of crew leaders, a couple of trucks, and they lead volunteers to come out and install energy efficiency measures in the homes. One of the side benefits is that when you're done, you can go do it at your house, and it's pretty easy. So you're out there and you're doing this work, and you're like, this is something that I could do at home. And so it kind of has this like ripple effect in volunteers' lives.
Great. And right now, there's an opportunity to leverage funds from Duke. Can you tell us about how that would work?
Yeah. So Duke Energy Progress has a program for low-income weatherization, and they're the ones that fund most of our work in this on this front. And recently, we were allowed to start getting additional funding for the volunteer hours. So when volunteers come out and work with us, their hours are matched with dollars to expand and continue the program. So it's self-sustaining, and hopefully we'll be able to expand a little bit later this year and to do another crew. So that'd be pretty cool.
The volunteers can know that they are actually helping society to harvest the low-hanging fruit of conservation. Conservation is one of the easiest ways that we can address our imminent need to reduce our use of fossil fuels. But they're also having an impact on the lives of the people whose homes they are weatherizing. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. The weatherizing is a big word for people to get their minds around, and it's a really simple thing. It's really two big pieces. One is swapping out lighting, so LED lights for what's there. Sometimes it's compact fluorescent, so CFL, the squiggly ones. Sometimes it's incandescent, which are the old technology that's very inefficient. So that's part of it is LED lighting. And then also water measures, because when you heat water, you use a lot of energy. So we swap out low-flow shower heads and low-flow faucet aerators. But the bigger amount of time is spent doing air sealing in homes and in mobile homes. And that is going around and sealing up gaps and cracks. So like not like windows or like where they open and close, like stuff that's stable. A lot of times you find this like under a sink where the pipe goes through the wall. You find these at like the top of the trim. It's like these hidden areas that have air leakage where the expensive air inside your house is leaving and the cheap air from outside your house is coming in, and you're trying to like keep those separate so that you're not trying to heat or cool the outside.
And what are the details? What is the timeline both for the commitment that people would be making and when it's going to happen? And how will people get involved if they want to help as volunteers? And what is enough volunteers?
So it's one of those things where if you want to try it out, there's no real commitment. You can just come for one day and check it out. So if you go to our website, you can set up your like volunteer profile and sign a waiver online. And then after that, you can choose any day from the calendar that's live and updated on our website on a regular basis. And then once you commit to that, you'll come out and the crew leader will train you on site. And jobs are generally Tuesday through Friday. Often they start 10 or 10:30 in the morning and they go as long as they go, but we stay until like 2 or 3 in the afternoon. So there's a short break for lunch. Definitely bring your lunch. And it's great. You end up, they're all over the county. They're in the city, these job sites. And so it varies greatly where we are each day. So definitely check the calendar to find something that's near you. And the calendar is updated every 2 or 3 weeks. So if you haven't looked at it in a while, you should come back and check again. There aren't any Saturdays right now, but we're looking at expanding to that. And in the summer, we're also going to have an apprenticeship program, and that'll be a little different. But generally, volunteers can come any day, Tuesday to Friday, and it's throughout the county.
And have you been able to track what the impact of weatherization work is for the beneficiaries of your endeavors? How much of a difference does it make?
In some homes, it's really dramatic. One of the homes we analyzed last year was something like a 43% reduction in energy use. It was amazing. And the biggest savings we saw there was from working on part of their HVAC system, so their heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system, by sealing up part of the ductwork that was kind of hanging loose. They actually couldn't even use that room. It was too cold in the winter, too hot in the summer, and by like attaching everything again, it works better now, and they can use that room in their home. So that was pretty cool, like that huge reduction in energy use and therefore energy bill savings. Sometimes it doesn't go that way. So the average is about $200 per project of savings. 20 of that is from water savings, and 180 of that is from heating and air conditioning and electricity. But yeah, no, it varies widely what people's savings are. It can be a huge amount. It can be not very much, but the average is about $200 a house per year. And the last about 10 years, the measures we're putting in. So that'd be about 10 grand or two grand per house.
And if tomorrow we suddenly as a nation got that we had to actually take immediate and serious action to address the looming threats of climate change, and we decided that we would fully fund the Green Built Alliance's agenda, what would the impact be, and what would you all do?
Oh, you want me to dream?
I do. I want us all to dream, actually.
So we are working this angle from the resources that we've got, and low-income folks are usually not the best way to save energy. It's actually a really expensive way to do it because our housing stock is so crummy. If we could, like, really dreaming pie in the sky, if we could swap out every mobile home in the county that was built before, I think it's 1976, is when HUD, the Human and Urban Development Department, I think that's what HUD stands for, when they started regulating housing conditions for mobile homes, it got a lot better. There are a lot of mobile homes that are before that regulation that people are still living in Buncombe County. So, like, if I could wave a magic wand, I would replace all of those with new energy-efficient mobile homes or new energy-efficient stick-built houses. Within the realm of, like, we're not talking, like, pie-in-the-sky dreams, but within the realm of, like, kind of what's coming up next that is pretty exciting is electrification. About half of our renewable energy goals in Buncombe County will be met by the electrification of our cars and trucks and the electrification of our water heat and air heat in our buildings. So if you can switch from a gas or propane or wood form of heating where you're burning fossil fuels or burning fuel and switch to electrification, which is a heat pump, if you can also do that for your water heater and then also switch to an electric vehicle, that is half of your renewable energy goal right there. So if Buncombe County could do that, that would be huge. And that would be like, if we could do that within my career, which is probably, hopefully, you know, I'm in my 40s, like 20 more years, that would be a huge win. And I think we're already on our way. So I'm kind of excited about that. So there you go. There's your half dream of what success looks like.
And so this is one that I didn't anticipate asking, but as I got that dream from you, I'm always uncomfortable with relying on nothing but electric heat because I remember the storm of the century when the power was out for many people for 10 days and the temperatures were sub-zero. What do we do when that happens?
Oh, it's not just that. I also like the idea of if we live in a wooded area, being self-reliant and being able to burn wood in a wood stove is good in those emergency situations, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I would argue we're not quite there yet. I also don't like paying a huge energy bill in the winter. So it's like one of those things where, hey, we have to do everything all at once. We have to do energy efficiency and air sealing so our energy bills come down. We have to invest in renewable energy generation so that we have battery or solar generation on site. And we have to make sure that nobody is left out. So we have to do it in an equitable way. So I don't actually have a good answer to that question right now. For what it's worth, I think that if you're switching out your heat pump, it does have a backup heat source, but it is an electric burner. So some people do end up keeping their fossil fuel heat source in their home as a backup when they get a heat pump. It's so variable and different across every housing unit, how things are set up now. It's hard to give like a blanket, here's how to solve that problem or that anxiety. We have so much work to do. I would recommend just starting somewhere, and we'll get there. And if the last thing you give up is your fossil fuel backup heat source, I'll accept that, you know, if you start working on the other angles.
Well, thanks for dreaming with me, and thanks for doing this work. And I hope that a bunch of people get in touch with you and learn how to weatherize and help people who need help.
We'd love to have them. Thanks for having us.
Be sure to tune in to Distant Planet with DJ Matthew Marks, Monday nights at 8 p.m., as he explores electronic and electroacoustic musics throughout their recorded histories. Immerse yourself in more than half a century of sounds made with or processed with machines. That's Monday nights at 8 p.m. right here on Asheville FM.
You're listening to the Asheville FM News Hour. Well, the Progressive Alliance of Henderson County has partnered with Working Films to present a screening of a documentary called Calls from Home, followed by a panel discussion on Building Community, Not Prisons, which is a national coalition currently fighting the proposed $500 million construction of a new 1,400-bed federal prison in Letchester County, Kentucky. This week, we got a chance to discuss the screening with the filmmaker and the Working Films campaign director. Thank you both so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Andy, why don't we start with you? And if you could just give a brief introduction to Working Films and what you all are doing over there.
Yeah. So Working Films is a organization that really believes in the power of documentaries to support activists and social justice issues. And so one of our programs is a funding opportunity where we basically fund documentaries on different issues that really let the leaders of those issues decide which films are funded. And so for this project that focused on police and prisons, our staff ourselves, we did not make the funding decisions, but instead reached out to other local organizers who've been working on those issues for a long time to ultimately decide which films were needed and which films deserved funding.
Mm-hmm.
How did
you get connected then with Sylvia and Calls from Home?
Yes, yeah, so Sylvia is the filmmaker of Calls from Home, and so that's one of the films that our partner organizations picked for funding this past round.
All right. And Sylvia, you wanted to introduce yourself to our listeners and a little bit of background with Calls for Home?
Yes, thank you so much. My name is Sylvia Ryerson, and just thrilled to get to share with you here on these community airwaves, which is really exactly the kind of place that this film, Calls from Home, grew out of. I was a reporter and community radio DJ at a sister station to yours mm-hmm. in the mountains of Eastern Kentucky, WMMT-FM, Mountain Community Radio. And the Calls from Home documentary centers around a long-standing radio show that, starting in the late 90s, people incarcerated in the prison system, sent extremely far away from home in rural prisons in the region, connected with DJs on air, and this led to this ongoing radio show where families call in to send shout outs to their loved ones currently incarcerated over the public airwaves. And mm-hmm. So that's the focus of the film, and it's sort of showing about, it's really trying to show the relationships that have been built through this radio station over the year and how we need to work together to sort of work across all these geographies of the carceral state to work together to confront the system.
Mm-hmm. And we should say WMMT is part of Apple Shop as well, which probably some of our listeners are more familiar with.
That's right. It's Apple Shop, APPAL, as in Appalachia, which is a longstanding, incredible media arts and education center in Whitesburg, Kentucky. Has a long history of activist work in the region.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell us about just Calls from Home itself and how it got started and what the goal is.
So the show first got started. There were, so I guess a little context is that WMMT Community Radio is in the corner of Southeast Kentucky in Letcher County, Kentucky. And this region, like many other rural areas, poor rural areas in this country, has become one of the most concentrated areas of rural prison and jail growth nationwide. And in the span of just a few decades, over a dozen new prisons were built in the central Appalachian region of Southwest Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, Southern West Virginia, and East Tennessee. And to date, there are currently 8 prisons that fall within the local broadcast area of WMMT. And when 2 super maximum security state prisons opened in Wise County, Virginia, just across the state border from Letcher County, adjacent to Letcher County in Wise County, they're called Red Onion State Prison and Wallens Ridge State Prison, and they're 2 super maximum security Virginia state prisons. And people who were sent there when the prisons first started, filling beds in the late 90s, people started listening to this late night hip hop R&B show that was on WMT, started writing letters into the radio station and calling in to see if they could send messages out to their friends and family over the airwaves. And importantly, at that time, there was sort of exorbitant rates for prison phone calls. It was costing families up to $8 for a 20-minute phone call to connect with their loved ones inside. And so people incarcerated also started sharing the radio station's toll-free phone number back to their families far away in Eastern Shore, Virginia, in Richmond, all the way across the state, saying like, hey, call into this number and they'll let you give a shout out on air as a way to connect to circumvent those extraordinarily high phone rates. Mm. And so it's been ongoing since then now for over two decades. And I think a lot of other kinds of organizing and relationships have grown out of the connections that were forged through that radio show.
Mm-hmm. And so then you got involved with Working Films and started creating the documentary, and now you're finished.
That's right. I was so thrilled, and it's just been an honor to get to be a part of this collaboration with Working Films. I started filming in 2019, and then once I was able to secure the support from Working Films, that really totally changed everything and made it possible for us to complete this project and get it out there. And so it's just been a complete honor and privilege to get to partner with Working Films on this. So the film is done, and now we're in the midst of our impact tour, trying to get this out, share it with communities, and have it actually support the incredible organizing on the ground against mass incarceration throughout the United States, and also specifically throughout the Central Appalachian region, and plugging into some amazing campaigns on the ground happening in that work right now.
Yeah. Andy, I'm sure that the work that you're doing then is really rewarding when you hear folks like Sylvia talking about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think also just now that we're on this side of it, when the film is finished and it's now getting out into the world, it's also for me like proof of concept for this Docs in Action program, because the films that have come out of it, I think, are very much in line with the needs of the movement. So with Sylvia's film right now, what you're seeing is this, you know, this real opportunity for the film to be screened really throughout the whole Appalachian region around what's going on with this proposed prison. And so, yeah, it's just really a nice proof of concept for what types of films can be created when movement leaders are the ones who are deciding which films should be created.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the proposed prison, either one of you, if you want to talk about how that pulls into your work here.
Yeah. Sylvia, do you want to start?
Yeah, absolutely. So currently, there are plans being made to build a new 1,400-bed federal prison in Letcher County, Kentucky, which is the home county of WMMT Radio. And if built, it will become the ninth prison to fall within WMMT's local listening area, and thousands of more people will be separated thousands and hundreds and thousands of miles from their families. There's an incredible coalition right now that's working extremely hard to fight this proposal. And we are in a really pivotal moment, actually, in the campaign right now. This prison has been fought for a long time. Congressman Hal Rogers, who's the representative for the 5th Congressional District of Eastern Kentucky, has essentially been bringing federal prisons to Eastern Kentucky throughout his tenure, through his position on the House Appropriations Committee, and he already built three other prisons, federal prisons, in Eastern Kentucky. And he has, since nearly 20 years now, he's been trying to build a fourth federal prison in Letcher County, and it's been defeated once before, and then the proposal came back, and so we're working to defeat it again. And right now, we're in this crucial public comment period that the as a federal project, it is required to go through what's called an environmental impact statement process, the EIS process, as required by NEPA, the National Environmental Protection Act, that require the review of all federal construction projects. And the Federal Bureau of Prisons released its first environmental impact statement on the proposed site, which opens up a 45-day public comment period that was released on March 1st, and so it's open until April 15th. So we basically have two more weeks right now to get as many public comments submitted to demonstrate the enormous opposition there is to this prison. And two things I want to say specifically is that, and the site is cited to be built on a former mountaintop removal job in Letcher County, which we know is an extremely unhealthy environment for anybody to have to live on. And this is also a federal prison. This is all of our federal taxpayer dollars going to build this prison. So everyone has a right to comment on the fact that we think we should spend our federal taxpayer dollars otherwise on all the things that actually work to keep our community safe, like education and housing and healthcare and so much more. And that's what this coalition is demanding, is for these funds to be rescinded from the federal budget so the prison is not built here in Letcher County or anywhere. And the other thing I want to highlight for your listeners is that the way the Bureau of Prisons works is that essentially, it will incarcerate people from all across the United States. Once you're sent into the federal system, you can go anywhere. But the Bureau of Prisons divides up the country into these sort of regions, and the proposed Letcher Prison will fall in what's called the Bureau of Prisons Mid-Atlantic area, which includes all Mid-Atlantic states from Maryland to Tennessee. It's really our region, and it specifically includes North Carolina. So North Carolina is poised to be a sending state so that people from Asheville could end up in this prison in eastern Kentucky if it's built. So we really need the voices of everyone in this region to join us in opposing this.
That's good information. Is there a way that folks can easily access how to do that?
Yes. If you could just go to our campaign website, it is buildingcommunitynotprisons.com. And I know you can link to that in the show notes. And if you go to that page, there's a clear link for you to submit your comment today. And we have a really easy form. It'll just take literally a couple minutes. We just need you to sign in and express your opposition. And that will really help us demonstrate that there's widespread opposition to this.
Mm-hmm. And Andy, folks can also get more information because you have a screening of this film as well as getting this information out to folks too, right? Here locally.
Yeah, exactly. On Thursday, April 11th, we're hosting a screening at the Flat Rock Cinema. And so that's going to be at 6:30 start time, hosted by the Progressive Alliance of Henderson County, along with Working Films and the Building Community Not Prisons Coalition. And so we're going to have a screening, share a meal, and then have a discussion about this campaign and walking people through submitting comments.
And do you have a specific website or any other information for folks locally?
Yeah, I think if folks want to go to, we have a bit.ly page, so bit.ly/callsfromhomehendo. There you can find more information or go to the Progressive Alliance of Henderson County Facebook or website for more information.
Great. Well, I appreciate both of you for the work that you're doing. I think this is really a great and incredible work that needs to be done. Is there anything further that you want to add before I let you go?
I'll just say for folks who might be listening that are overall trying to push back against prisons and the prison industrial complex, this is just a really concrete way to push back on that. Time and time again, when prisons have been created for a variety of reasons, including saying things like, oh, we're going to make conditions better by creating more prisons so that people are less crowded, every time that happens, the prisons get filled. When prisons are built, they get filled. So in terms of fighting back against prisons and the prison industrial complex, this is one of the most opportune windows is to prevent the prisons from being built in the first place.
And Sylvie, anything else you want to add?
I completely agree with what Andy said. And just on behalf of the coalition, we really need everyone's help right now. We just have, you know, till April 15th to get these comments in. So if people can help us share the campaign, you know, submit your comment and then share it with your family, share it with your friends, share it with your organizations in the region. And we really need your help right now. More broadly, the film is really trying to show like the role of community radio in helping to forge these relationships, you know. And one sort of secret hope I have is that other similar shows grow out of this. Like, I'm sure that your station reaches jails or ICE detention centers or prisons, like thinking about the institutions that are within your broadcast area. You know, the community radio is just an incredible infrastructure that we already have to do that. And as we know, it's going to take stations like ours, yours, and WMMT. It's not going to be, obviously, it's not going to be commercial radio. It's not going to be NPR. It's like stations like these that can create that space on air. So thanks so much. And I'll be joining Andy remotely for the screening next week and really psyched to connect with people that are able to come to that event as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you again both for joining me. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up next, No Borders, a new show right here on Asheville FM. And in the app and online at AshevilleFM.org.
That was Sylvia Ryerson, director of the film Calls from Home, and Andy Myers, director of campaigns and strategies with Working Films. Again, the screening of Calls from Home is Thursday, April 11th at 6:30 at the Flat Rock Cinema. That's in Flat Rock, North Carolina. And the film screening includes a discussion about mass incarceration in Appalachia and the campaign itself. We'll have more information on our Facebook page.
Hi, I am Dr. Dick Needleman, health reporter for 103.3 Asheville FM, with this week's Healthy Asheville Health Report. In local news, respiratory infections like COVID-19, influenza, and RSV are characterized by being more prevalent during the winter months. With the recent onset of spring, the winter surge of respiratory infections has passed. However, over the past 3 years, COVID-19 infections have also surged in August. Therefore, the weekly update will continue to report on COVID-19 and restart influenza and RSV updates in the fall. The CDC's COVID dashboard for the week ending on March 23rd shows hospital admission levels are low in every county in North Carolina, including Buncombe County. They are low in almost 99% of the counties in the U.S. and medium in about 1%. Admissions have decreased in the U.S., North Carolina, and Buncombe County from the previous week. About 2 to 3% of the deaths in North Carolina were due to COVID, the third lowest level of six groups. Emergency room visits for COVID-19 are minimal in North Carolina. This is about 1% of all ER visits, the lowest level of five groups. Wastewater monitoring can be used to provide early warning for COVID outbreaks. The Buncombe and Henderson counties wastewater data on the North Carolina COVID dashboard for the week ending on March 20th shows the number of viral gene copies in each water sample is at a yellow level, representing the third highest level of five groups, currently between the 40th and 60th percentile relative to the past level measured at the same site. The 15-day rate of change of the number of viral gene copies in each water sample has decreased from the previous week, between minus 99% to minus 10%, the lowest level of two groups for a negative rate of change. In national news, it is now illegal to smoke in motor vehicles in West Virginia with children present. On March 22nd, West Virginia became the 12th state to protect children in motor vehicles from the harms of secondhand smoke. According to the law, persons 16 and under cannot be exposed to a lit tobacco product or to someone smoking. Smoking with children present cannot be the main reason that a driver is pulled over. However, Lawbreakers can be fined up to $25 if they are stopped for another offense. The other 11 states that prohibit smoking in motor vehicles with children present are Alabama, Arkansas, California, Delaware, Illinois, Louisiana, Maine, Oregon, Utah, Vermont, and Virginia. The age limits vary according to state. North Carolina does not prohibit smoking in motor vehicles with children present. According to the CDC, exposure to secondhand smoke from burning tobacco products like cigarettes, cigars, and pipes can cause non-smokers to develop illnesses associated with smoking, and these can contribute to premature death. Exposure to secondhand smoke occurs when people breathe in smoke from burning tobacco products or from people who exhale while smoking. Any level of exposure can be harmful. Tobacco smoke contains hundreds of harmful chemicals, including about 70 that can cause cancer. Heart disease, stroke, lung disease, and reproductive health problems like low birth weight newborns have been associated with exposure to secondhand smoke. Children are impacted more than adults, including sudden infant death syndrome, lung infections, asthma, and ear infections. Smoking is prohibited in many indoor spaces, like at work, public places, restaurants, and at bars, in order to protect people from secondhand smoke exposure. According to the CDC, between 2 to 3 million non-smokers died from health problems that were caused by exposure to secondhand smoke since 1964. Protecting defenseless children from the harms of secondhand smoke is a good public health policy. In more national news, the CDC recently reported that U.S. life expectancy at birth in 2022 is 77.5 years, about a one-year increase from 2021. There are fewer deaths from COVID-19, heart disease, cancer, unintentional injuries, and homicides, according to the report. The life expectancy has dropped in 2020 and 2021 due to the large number of COVID-19 deaths and drug overdoses. In 2021, the U.S. life expectancy was 76.4 years, the lowest since 1996. In 2019, before the COVID-19 pandemic, the life expectancy was 78.8 years. The peak life expectancy was almost 79 in 2014, 10 years ago. The leading causes of death for 2022 and 2021 are the same, although some of the causes changed ranks. The leading causes of 2022 deaths in the U.S. are heart disease and cancer, and have been since the early 1990s. COVID-related deaths fell from third to fourth, more than a 50% decline from the previous year. Accidents and unintentional injuries, like drug overdoses, increased from fourth to third, although the number of overdose deaths were similar between 2021 and 2022. Over the past 20 years, drug overdose deaths were almost four times more frequent. Rising infant mortality rate from low birth weight newborns, congenital problems, and sudden infant death syndrome contribute to lowering the life expectancy rate. The infant mortality rate increased by more than 3% between 2021 and 2022. Life expectancy can be determined from birth and at the age 65. Life expectancy at birth for women exceeds men by more than 5 years. The average male lives almost 75 years in 2022, while females live to 80. For persons at age 65, the life expectancy is almost 84. Females exceeded males by 3 years. The U.S. has the lowest life expectancy among large, wealthy countries. However, it spends much more on health care per capita. These countries have life expectancy above 80 years and per capita health spending from about 40 to 64% of the U.S. Germany, United Kingdom, Austria, Canada, Netherlands, Belgium, France, Sweden, Australia, Switzerland, and Japan. This has been Dr. Dick Needleman with the Healthy Asheville Health Report.